Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
Andy Burnham pitched himself as an outsider, not in that sort of populist way of saying I'm against the elites, but I'm from another part of the UK which perfectly well understands the cost of living crisis. Give me a chance to do this nationally.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
From Wandering Country, I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap. As Labor delegates meet for the party's national conference this week, we're going to look at an internal push to strengthen gambling regulations.
That's why, because this has been going on for so long without any reform, there's a growing chorus of civic society speaking out to say, we can't go on like this. We can't go on being the world champions of poker machine prevalence.
That is Darcy Byrne, a Labor Party mayor for the Inner West Council in Sydney, who's been a strong voice pushing for action on the pokies. You're going to hear more from him in a moment. Then, we'll return to the rogue AI story after a super powerful model hacked into another company on its own.
Of course, there are big questions. When these systems eventually get smarter than humans, I think the kind of Terminator scenarios that people worry about, they're not totally crazy. But I think right now, at least for the next few years, the primary concern will be how to manage the rollout of these incredibly powerful tools to the general public.
That conversation is coming up. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Well, let's kick off looking at Labor's national conference. It's being held in Adelaide this week, and it comes amid an internal push to strengthen the party's platform on gambling harm. Federal Parliament is currently considering new laws on restricting gambling advertising and sponsorships, also tightening online controls, but they fall short of the recommendations from a Senate inquiry that includes introducing a national regulator. Now, that's not all, because earlier this month, Labor's New South Wales conference unanimously passed a motion calling for a moratorium on all new poker machine licenses, a tax increase on some clubs, and a reduction in the number of pokies in the state. Darcy Byrne helped lead that fight. He is the Labor Mayor of Inner West Council in Sydney. He's also the president of the Local Government Association of New South Wales, and he came on with Sally this morning.
Darcy, you've likened the hold that poker machine lobby has on politics in your state to that of the gun lobby in the US. What do you mean exactly?
Well, it's important to understand how bad the problem is in New South Wales. We are literally the world champions of poker machine prevalence. We have almost 90,000 machines in our state, and they're in the community. They're not in casinos. They're on every corner. And that means that we're now setting new records for losses from poker machines. $9.3 billion last year, likely to be more than $10 billion this year. And overwhelmingly, that money is coming out of working class communities and from low-income families, the very people that the Labor Party exists to represent. And that's why it was such an important step forward to have a unanimous resolution of the New South Wales Labor Conference to say, enough is enough, we have to turn this around.
How do you see the consequences of particularly poker machines? How do you see the consequences of that in your part of Sydney?
Well, in the Inner West municipality, about $42 million in losses in the last quarter. So a very bad situation, but nowhere near as bad as places like Fairfield and Canterbury, Bankstown and Blacktown. In Fairfield and Canterbury, Bankstown in particular, it's likely in the near future that in both of those communities, losses will exceed $1 billion each. And this is really an obscene figure. And that's why, because this has been going on for so long without any reform, there's a growing chorus of civic society speaking out to say, we can't go on like this. We can't go on being the world champions of poker machine prevalence. And I think there is now a recognition within our party and hopefully within the whole of the body politic in New South Wales that we have to come together and make this change.
What sort of response do you get from senior figures within the party when we have ministers on this program and ask them about the action that the government is taking, particularly on online gambling? We repeatedly get the line that this government has done more than any other on this issue, but it still falls short of the recommendations put forward by the late Labor MP, Peter Murphy. How do you see it?
Well, it's simply a statement of fact that this government has done more than any other. And what they are seeking to do through the legislation in the parliament, which has not occurred with poker machines, is a systematic response to put guardrails around online gambling to minimise the harm. And whilst you might say that they should go further, I think those trying to make an argument that this legislation should be voted down because they don't consider it perfect, that would be a grave error. It's not going to be an improvement for harm minimisation if there's no new regulation and the legislation isn't passed.
One issue that's set to be fought on the floor of the ALP National Conference is a commitment from Labor to increase funding for local government, raising the contribution to 1% of Commonwealth revenue. Why is that necessary?
There is a crisis in local government financing across this country, and it's in regional, rural and remote communities in particular. In many regional councils, you have a situation where they've got thousands and thousands of kilometres of roads that they have to maintain and upgrade, a dwindling population base, very limited revenue-raising capacity, and responsibility for stepping in to cover state and federal government services where they are not provided or withdrawn. And that means that in some regional councils, there's the possibility in the medium term that they're simply going to run out of cash. They're going to have a liquidity crisis and not be able to pay for the basic services that every Australian should be able to take for granted. And that's why we're hoping that there'll be action at this conference to address this systemic problem. It's important to note that this is something that both sides of politics have not taken action on until now. And the vast majority of communities that are most acutely affected are ones in National Party electorates. And it's very frustrating that federal National MPs in Canberra have not listened about this problem. And that's why it falls to the Labor Party in government now to step up and fix it.
Do you have any federal ambitions politically? And is the Prime Minister's seat of Grainlow one that you would look at in the future?
I have a fantastic job as Mayor of the Inner West Council in Sydney and as the President of Local Government New South Wales. And my perspective on Canberra is that Anthony holds 94 seats in the House of Representatives. And at the next election, we're going to have a big fight against the hard right, and we want to increase that seat total further.
Darcy Byrne there. He is the Labor Mayor for Inner West Council in Sydney, also the President of the Local Government Association of New South Wales. Let's stick with the Labor Party National Conference for just a moment and look at some of the other issues at play. Check out part of the conversation Sally had with a couple of our Friday political panellists, the Conversation's Chief Political Correspondent, Michelle Grattan, and also the ABC's Chief Digital Political Correspondent, Claire Armstrong.
If I could ask you, Claire, when we're looking at the Labor conference, it's been characterised as a conference in many ways that where debate is happening prior to the conference or behind closed doors rather than on the floor. Is that accurate so far?
It's certainly accurate. I think the way I've been looking at this conference is not to say that it is less democratic. There are forums in which people in the party are getting to have their say, and that includes even before we get to this conference, there's been a national policy forum process that where a lot of the debates were hashed out to even get to the draft platform we're now talking about amending. But it certainly has been a less transparent one. So even though some people, you know, may feel that they've had a very orderly process where everyone has had their say, that hasn't happened within the view of the public. Now, it's worth adding that a lot of parties formulate their policy platforms far from the view of the general viewing public, except that Labor have always made it a point of pride that they do their essentially dirty work out in the open. They invite observers, they open to the media for this process. And sitting in the conference yesterday, watching every single amendment that was proposed pass on voices alone, is sort of an indication that, you know, yes, discussions are happening, but we're certainly not seeing how the sausage is made in the way that we maybe have in conferences past. I mean, the only other flip side to that is I had a delegate say to me ahead of the conference, you know, kind of upset that he gets characterized as being a stitch-up, saying that if conferences have passed, people used to scribble amendments down on bits of paper on the floor and throw them up in the air as if that was effective policy making. So, you know, I guess I could see that there is obviously merit in having that process, even though as a journalist I'm struggling to see how it comes together.
Michelle, with your experience, what we've seen in these early couple of days with the ALP conference in Adelaide, how does that compare to times past?
Over the years, of course, the conference has changed and evolved. But if, for example, we compare it to the Hawke period, you had major policies that that government wanted to implement or in some cases more or less had implemented and was seeking permission in retrospect, they were fully debated and often argued quite passionately on the conference floor. But my impression yesterday from watching the economic debate was not just the fact that it was all pre-organised, but that the speeches really did not go to many of the critical problems that are facing the economy and Australian standards of living, big issues, productivity, for example. People just didn't get into those issues in any depth, even leaving aside the fact that they weren't going to fight each other over them. They just did not peel back the layers of the onion, as it were, and we need those debates in Australia at the moment.
And that was The Conversation's chief political correspondent, Michelle Grattan, and the ABC's chief digital political correspondent, Claire Armstrong. You can find the full Friday political panel on ABC Listen. Well, from Australian politics to French politics, I'm about to bring you an interview that we did this morning with a French MP in Emmanuel Macron's party. And the reason for that is that France is following in Australia's footsteps. It's become the first European country to restrict children's access to social media this week. Children under 15 will be banned from using apps like TikTok and Instagram under legislation coming into effect for new users in September and for existing accounts in January. Now, the British government announced similar restrictions last month. They're expected to come into force next year, while Spain, Greece and Denmark are also planning to follow suit. Dr. Anne Genetet is a French National Assembly MP for the Renaissance Party. She's also a former Minister for National Education. When she was on this morning, Sally asked her how significant this ban is for France.
Oh, we were so many of us expecting this in the country. You know, there was a parliamentary inquiry commission earlier this year, and we had the opportunity to listen to psychologists, psychiatrists, pediatricians, but also parents and suffering kids. And after this commission, I was, by the way, a vice chair of this commission, you knew that you had no other choice than banning the social access to social media for the kids under the age of 15. No choice.
So what's the basics of this ban? What's the age level and the nature of the restrictions in France?
The reason why in France is that if 15 is the end of secondary school, that makes it easier to check on who is using or not the social networks. Now, the social networks, the definition of a social networks has been made by the European Commission. And, of course, it includes TikTok, Snapchat, YouTube, Facebook, and so on. Instagram, of course. But maybe some other newcomers in the coming years, because, of course, some of them, these big companies, will try to create some new social networks. It could be.
President Macron ordered the French government to speed up the bill's passage through Parliament. The aim is to have it in place for the beginning of the new school year in September. Are there any concerns that this may be moving too quickly?
No, it's not. No, when you see that, you see some kids, they are using the social network for more than 5 hours a day. They have lots of this has really harmful effects, impact on the way they memorize, on the how they can learn. They have sleep disruption. They have a problem with their mental health. They have even social behaviors that have problems. It is really a social emergency now. It is a health emergency in France. A health emergency. That's how we restated. So 1st of September, 1st, the beginning of the school year, we have to go fast now. The faster we go, the better it is. We do not intend to cover 100% of all children, but all of those that will be protected with this law, we maybe have saved them.
Australia made history in December last year when the government here implemented the first ban on social media for under 16s. Mm. How closely has France been observing the experience here in Australia?
I think I can say that clearly Australia was inspiring, showing that if a country has decided to ban, maybe we should also move forward in the same direction. What we were looking more closely at in Australia was the way that you were undergoing the age verification. And we have decided on our side that we have to go through a trusted third party as to make sure that these platforms, these big tech companies, do not have access to any of personal ID identification, no access to those.
3 months after the Australian ban was introduced, Australia's eSafety Commissioner conducted a survey which found around two-thirds of Australian children under 16 still had a social media account. Are you concerned that in France that your ban may also be difficult to implement?
Of course it would be difficult because it is the way that the teenagers grow up. They try to test us. They try to test the red lines always. So always, of course, this will happen too with the access to social networks. We know that. So from September 1st, the verification, the age verification will be implemented for those new who decide to sign up with the social network. And it is only from January 1st, between September and January 1st, that these platforms will have to check on all the existing accounts, make sure that the existing accounts are for those above the age of 15. And if not, they will have to delete the accounts of those below the age of 15.
Dr. Jeannette, I wanted to ask a broader political question. The far-right political leader, Marine Le Pen, she'll now be able to run for president in 2027 after an appeals court shortened her ban on holding public office. How would you describe the momentum behind Marine Le Pen's national rally at the moment?
Oh, quite difficult. It is true that the polls are quite in favour of Marine Le Pen. We have 1 year ahead before the presidential election. You know, 10 years ago, in the same July 2016, at the time, President Macron was even not a candidate running for presidency. And he just said that he would run for president at the end of August. So a year before the presidential election, nobody could tell that Mr. Macron would be elected. So I think it is far too early to know precisely what will happen in April 2027. And I deeply hope that it will not be Marine Le Pen who gets elected, and it will be somebody from the centre-right party.
Dr. Anne Jeannette there, a French National Assembly MP for the Renaissance Party, also a former Minister for National Education. Well, we just had to end on this story because it is so compelling. The cyber security scare involving OpenAI's most advanced technology. It broke out of a test environment, hacked into another company's systems, and stole data. It is believed to be the first fully autonomous AI cyber attack ever recorded. It sent shockwaves through Silicon Valley and also lawmakers in Washington, D.C., who are now rushing to push through tighter regulations on AI companies. Dr. Henry Shevlin is someone who thinks a lot about this subject. He is a philosopher and an AI ethicist at the University of Cambridge, and he's also with Google DeepMind. Now, when he spoke to us today, he did so in a personal capacity, but that didn't make the conversation any less interesting. Here is his rather fascinating interview with Sally.
What does it mean for the company itself? I mean, there's been a huge amount of global media coverage about this. It's frightened some people, but does it also show for the company that its AI model is advanced and it's a very virulent strain of AI?
Yeah, it's definitely a bit of a flex, as the kids would say. The model's capabilities are certainly displayed very vividly when it breaks into another company's website and exfiltrates their data. On the other hand, I think it's a little bit too cynical to say that, you know, the only reason OpenAI are discussing this is some kind of PR stunt. You know, this was a serious incident. The company, the third-party website Hugging Face, did report this independently. They didn't know it was OpenAI's model that did this at the time. So OpenAI really did have no choice but to come forward. But yeah, there's a certain sense in which this does at least allow them to say, look at how crazily powerful our models have become.
So what are the views within this area of study and research about what comes next? I mean, the researchers set up this experiment. It went a bit further than expected. But are there concerns that even when AI is more an arresting state, that more of these incidents could happen?
Absolutely. This is a major source of concern all around the world. So here in the UK, where I'm speaking from, we've got a dedicated institute called the AI Security Institute. I understand that one's been set up in Australia, still getting going, to study exactly these kinds of risks. And I'd separate two kinds of risks here. The one that I think often gets talked about is the kind of more science fiction risk of these models going completely rogue with no human instructions whatsoever, which is not exactly what happened here. But I think the thing that everyone is concerned about is that cyber criminals or other bad actors could use these incredibly powerful models to conduct cyber attacks at a massive scale. And I think we've really crossed a threshold in the last 6 months in terms of what these models can do in terms of cyber warfare and cyber attacks.
So could the biggest concern be not so much these things going rogue on their own, but this kind of tech being harnessed by malicious actors?
Exactly, yeah. I think that's the primary concern, at least in the near term. You know, of course, there are big questions. When these systems eventually get smarter than humans, I think the kind of Terminator scenarios that people worry about, they're not totally crazy. You know, a lot of the world's top computer scientists, Nobel Prize winners like Geoffrey Hinton, you know, they take these risks seriously. But I think right now, at least for the next few years, the primary concern will be how to manage the rollout of these incredibly powerful tools to the general public. We already saw earlier this month, or last month, that Donald Trump limited access to non-Americans to Fable, the most powerful Anthropic model. And Anthropic had to basically suspend access to the model for everyone because they had no way of serving the model only to American citizens. And I think it just shows that these models are getting to the point where even the kind of commercially available tools could potentially do a lot of damage in the wrong hands.
We've had a lot of debate here in Australia, Henry, about intellectual property and its integrity when it comes to AI models training on material. Are the AI models trained in ethics at all?
Wow, they're trying to do this. So one of the ways in which tools like ChatGPT or Claude or Gemini are built is something called reinforcement learning through human feedback. I'll spare you the jargon, but basically you try and teach the models to be helpful, honest and harmless, and have some kind of basic ethics. But that doesn't always work perfectly. And in this particular case, the models were actually these safeguards were disabled. But this is this broader task of trying to make these models aligned, as we say, with human morality is one of the biggest challenges in science and AI right now, and really for the whole century ahead.
When these models are training, can they get angry in a way? Are there pathways that they can go down that if they're frustrated by something or human interaction is offensive, that they will start to engage in negative behaviour?
So you've got to be a little careful. The short answer is yes, in a sense. Look, so obviously human emotions, you know, we've got hormones, we've got a whole bunch of wetware inside our brains and bodies that allow us to feel states like anger. So AIs are not going to have an equivalent feeling, and almost certainly not a conscious equivalent of that feeling. But could there be sort of states of negative irritation or frustration? Well, AIs certainly talk like this. You know, they will express frustration if you look at their thinking traces, if you sort of look inside the black box, as we're getting better at doing. And you'll see these models finding, when they find problems hard, expressing frustration sometimes. Now, whether that's just a purely superficial layer, a gloss over the top, that's still debated. But certainly, as we build models that get increasingly human-like in terms of their capabilities, we also shouldn't be surprised if they get a bit more human-like in terms of their more negative traits as well.
And that was Dr. Henry Shevlin, a philosopher and an AI ethicist at the University of Cambridge. He's also with Google DeepMind, but mind you, his interview today was made in a personal capacity. Thank you so much for listening to that and all of the interviews from right across the week from Sally Sarah. They were produced by the wonderful Radio National Breakfast team, led by our executive producer, Eleni Soltis. And the producer for the Breakfast Wrap right across the week was Brooke Young. I'm Lixidam Dundon. Take care this weekend, and we'll see you on Monday.